From Essential Public Radio, I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is Essential Pittsburgh. The brutality, inhumanity, and extraordinary bravery associated with war are brought to life by a Pittsburgh-area Army Ranger in a new book called Outlaw Platoon. The book is written by Lieutenant Sean Parnell, a Murraysville native who served as a platoon leader in Afghanistan and took part in some of the fiercest fighting of the war. On today's show, Sean Parnell is my guest. He'll talk about making the transition from partying Duquesne University student one year to being a leader in a combat zone the next, the challenge of being a warrior diplomat, and the psychological wall he and his fellow soldiers built between themselves and the people they were sent to protect. The Outlaw Platoon on today's Essential Pittsburgh. First, this news. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has lasted for well over a decade, making it the second longest in American history after Vietnam. But how much do most Americans really understand about the nature of the conflict, the Afghan people, and the insurgents our troops are fighting against? There is a new book out that puts the reader in the middle of it all in a way that feels both vivid and visceral. It's called The Outlaw Platoon and is written by Murraysville native and former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger Sean Parnell, who served in the legendary 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain after receiving 2 Bronze Stars and the Purple Heart. On today's show, Sean Parnell is my guest. As the leader of the Outlaw Platoon in Afghanistan, he took part in some of the fiercest fighting of the war. He joins me now in Studio A. Sean Parnell, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
How much of a disconnect do you suppose that there is between what the general American public perceives about the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan and what's really happening there based on what you experienced?
Well, I think that that's one of the main reasons why I wrote the book. I wanted the American society to know and understand what the plight of the boots on the ground infantrymen is like and how combat affects them. And so that was the primary reason that I wrote the book. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that they fully understand what that's like. And again, that's why I wrote the book, to give them a window into the heart of the modern American infantryman.
Your book takes the reader on quite an emotional and nightmarish journey, and I found it to be a very satisfying but gut-wrenching read. What was it like to write Outlaw Platoon, and why did you choose to write it when you knew that you would have to revisit and relive some very unpleasant experiences?
Well, that's a great question, and I think for me, that writing the book was really, really difficult. I mean, it was cathartic in many ways, and it was therapeutic. I mean, there's something to be said about taking the war outside of yourself and putting it on the page, and in many ways that can be really difficult, but simultaneously therapeutic. But I think for my men and I, when we got back on our final formation from Afghanistan, we were standing on this concrete pad, and they were looking at me, and I was looking at them, and we had. They had said to me, "Sir, how am I ever going to tell my family about what we did in Afghanistan? How am I ever going to explain what combat was like to my friends?" And in that moment, I made them a promise to somehow figure out a way to tell their story. And so American warriors or veterans in general join the military because they want to protect the country that they're from. And when they come home, that mentality is no different. So if I'm sitting around a table and I'm talking to my buddies and I talk about somebody or a child dying in combat, that kind of affects the mood of what's happening around the table. And when a veteran sees that their experience is harming their friends or their family or people that they care about, they lock the war away inside them. And then what happens is the war eats away at them from the inside. So that causes a rift between American society and veterans that I think needs to be healed. And I think, I think American society in general needs to ask our veterans, like, hey, while I know that I can never understand what your experience was like, I can never understand what combat was like for you, but just teach me, and I'm ready to hear it. So for me, writing the book sort of served that purpose. I got the story out there, and not only my story, but the story of my men out there, so that I think Americans now recognize their sacrifice. And I think it's been therapeutic for them as well.
You talk about some of the things that happen during fighting and the innocent people that die, and almost from the moment that you land in Afghanistan, you end up in a situation where you're carrying a dying little girl in your arms.
Yeah.
Your baptism under fire came quickly.
Yeah, you know, it was so much for easing into combat. You know, there are no rules, and I think that's what's so hard for American soldiers from a Western culture where we are supposed to do everything that we can to protect our children because they can't protect themselves. And in that first day in combat, a lot of things happened for me. I saw how different their culture was from ours, because there was this argument going on at the front gate while there are these wounded and bleeding, dying children all around about how the Afghans wanted the boys treated first. Didn't matter how we executed, as long as the boys were treated first in our aid station. And I watched this and I was like, wow, this is how do you prepare for something like this? I mean, look, the cultural divide was so stark. So what had happened was, is, you know, we just ended up grabbing the kids, all of them at once, and I just so happened had a little girl, and on the way to the aid station she died, and that was my first moment in combat. And in a moment, in that moment, part of me died too. And I think that's that part of me was that insulated existence that I had known for my whole life here in the States was gone forever.
The outlaw platoon was part of a battalion with a glorious history. Explain how it got its name and the nature of the men who embraced that name and the logo one of your guys created that became an integral part of it.
Well, I was so right before we deployed, my non-commissioned officers, who I love dearly, and trained me. First of all, these guys trained me and taught me what it was like to be a leader and what it was like to be a good leader. But they had said, "Hey, sir, we need a unit identity. We need something to coalesce around when the bullets start flying, because the only thing that matters when the bullets start flying is each other." So not about the individual, it's about the collective whole, the collective unit. And so we settled on the outlaws. And what happened was, is we, you know, that settling on the outlaws like that, or calling our platoon the outlaws, gave our men an identity that they coalesced around and they lived. I mean, they had a guide on that we had made with the outlaw emblem on it, and they ran with it everywhere they went. They had T-shirts made, and they took that identity and they ran with it. And I think they accomplished amazing things in combat because of it.
My guest is former U.S. Army Ranger Sean Parnell, author of Outlaw Platoon. If you have a question or comment for him, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. You can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH, or you can email us at ESSPGH@essentialpublicradio.org. You write in your book that you were this kid sort of drifting through life until the events of 9/11 happened. Describe how that day changed your life.
Yeah, I was a sort of listless college student, and you know, I woke up in my dorm room, surrounded by beer cans on the floor and all around me on the couch, and I just woke up in sort of a stupor. I turned on the TV and I watched that. The first thing that I saw when I turned on the TVs with the World Trade Centers on fire. I watched the second plane crash into the second tower, and I watched the towers collapse. And here I was, you know, I'm surrounded by beer cans. I'm kind of wandering in life. I didn't really have a mission. And I watched the towers collapse on TV, and I knew in that moment that I had to respond. And so that same day, I went down to a recruiting station and talked about joining the Army that day and dropping out of school and enlisting. My dad was, of course, he was shocked by that decision, and you know, and then he explained to me that there are two sides to the enlisted corps and the officer corps. And he said, "Look, you've already got 2.5 years of college; just stick it out and go in as an officer." And of course, I didn't understand that dichotomy.
And you really, you lashed back at him in a hurtful way.
Yeah, I said, you know, we were arguing as he was driving me back up to Clarion University, which is where I was at the time, and he was like, you know, he was trying to convince me to go at it as an officer. And he was like, hey, Sean, I was like, hey, Dad, well, what did you do? You left the Naval Academy early. What do you have in your life to be proud of? And he just paused and the conversation died down. He goes, Sean, I got four things that I'm proud of every single day of my life. And he was referring to his children. And I was just like, well, insert your foot in mouth, Sean, and shut up and listen to your dad. And so I did. And, you know, he did everything. He was there for me every step of the way, as long with my mother helping me transfer schools to a program that had an ROTC program. So they, after that argument sort of died down, they supported me 150%, and I ended up going to Duquesne and joining the ROTC program there.
There were a lot of people who had the same reaction that you did immediately after 9/11, but you didn't end up actually going to Afghanistan until 5 years later in 2006. 5 years is a long time. Were there things that happened in the interim or that you learned about the nature of the conflict in Afghanistan that made you question your decision to join the Army?
You know, I don't think that I ever questioned my decision. In fact, when I was finally on scholarship at Duquesne and I finally knew that I was going to be joining the infantry, I was so focused on trying to figure out how to go from being a 24-year-old video game playing college kid to being a leader of men. And like that occupied all of my time. Once I joined the Army, I mean, I went, we did this, you know, 8 months was called Officer Basic Course, where they teach you the ropes of being an officer and the paperwork side of things and how to wear your uniform and everything like that. And I was totally focused on trying to figure that part out. And then I went to Airborne School, which is a really difficult school. And I was focused on making sure my parachute would open when I jumped out of airplanes. And then I went to Ranger School, and that was basically hell on earth. And so then I find myself in command of these men, and I was totally focused on trying to figure out how to be a good leader. I guess it's a simple answer to your question. And I wasn't really focused on the geopolitical situation in Afghanistan itself. You know, I was just a little nervous and scared, and I wanted to make sure that I put that in the book too about how scared I was.
Did you ever say to yourself, you know, once you got over there, that you know, we're following in the footsteps of the Soviets and others who were met with disaster in Afghanistan? How do we succeed?
Absolutely. I had a squad leader named Phil Baldwin who had read basically every book that there was on Afghanistan, and he was saying, hey, sir, we need to make sure that what we do there is different than the Soviets. And he sort of trained me up on the long history, the graveyard of empires that is Afghanistan. So when we got there, I mean, the big difference between us and the Soviets was that the Soviets were pretty ruthless with the people there, not just enemy combatants, but just the civilian populace, the local national Afghans. For us, we were exactly the opposite. I mean, every single mission, while we were loading, you know, ammunition in our trucks, we were also loading coloring books for kids, medicine, food, water, clothing for the winter. Every mission was simultaneously a humanitarian mission for us too. I mean, we genuinely cared about the Afghan citizens, and it was really important for us to protect them from the enemy, who is pretty ruthless to them too. So I think that was the big difference, specifically with regards to how we treated the people there. But I did. I mean, it was a question, like your question was always on the forefront of my mind, and especially with regards to how can we be different? How can we be different from all of these empires that had been in Afghanistan before us? And you know, I think the big difference was is that we really sought to take care of the Afghan people when we were there.
Our guest is Sean Parnell, and he, again, is the author of Outlaw Platoon. If you have a comment or question for him, 412-246-2002 is the number to call, 412-246-2002. We have Greg on the line from McCandless Township. Greg, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your comment or question.
Well, I'm learning so much, especially about the care of girls, and this is the March's Women's History Month. But my question, especially in relationship to all the tours of duty that so many men and women have done, I would like to know what Sean thinks about the draft, and it probably will never happen for political reasons, but I'd like to know that so many people are living their lives without even caring about the war, so I'd like to know what he thinks about reinstating the draft. Thank you.
What about reinstating the draft? You were with some men who were overworked and shell-shocked,
yeah,
and who had done repeated tours of duty. They were in your platoon. So when people talk about reinstating the draft, if for no other reason than to maybe alleviate the problem of these multiple tours of duty, what about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that our military is strapped. I mean, most of the – we've been at war for 10 years, two wars, and, you know, most – active duty Army service members or even military members of our military have deployed year on and year off deployments for these 10 years. And the year that they're home training, or the year that they're home, supposed to be spending time with their family, they're actually training in the field for the next go-round to combat. So you're talking about a force that is strapped. We have about a 547,000 man Army. And, you know... These people, our active duty service members pride themselves on being an all-volunteer force, you know? So I'm not sure – I mean, it would surely be nice to sort of share the load. But I think a draft, again, like Greg was saying, would never happen politically. I think politically in this country, I don't think we would stand for a draft ever again. But it would certainly lighten the load on the few that have bore the burden of these wars. I mean, I don't think there's any question that the U.S. military is at war, and not the U.S. itself. I mean, there's a huge rift between American society and our veterans. So while I think the draft would certainly lighten the load on those people, I think that politically, you know, it won't ever happen, like Greg was saying. But also, I think, you know, our all-volunteer Army prides himself on being all volunteers. You know, it's something that they take pride in. But certainly an important question. You know, I think the heart of Greg's question was, what can we do more to help these veterans that are struggling with multiple deployments?
We're talking with former U.S. Army Ranger Sean Parnell, author of Outlaw Platoon, and we will continue our conversation with him and take your calls again at 412-246-2002. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is 90.5 FM. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the book Outlaw Platoon, about the experiences of a Pittsburgh area native, Sean Parnell, a former Army Ranger who took part in some of the fiercest fighting in Afghanistan during the years of 2006 and 2007. If you have a comment or question for him, you can call us at 412-246-2002. You can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and by email at ESSPGH@essentialpublicradio.org. I should probably call you Captain Purnell because you retired as a captain, even though you're, through most of the story here, a lieutenant. So is that what you go by?
No, you can just call me Sean. That's fine. I'm retired captain, and you know, I'm very proud of my military service, but, making the transition to being a civilian again, you know.
Fair enough. Well, like you and others in your platoon, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales joined the Army just after the attacks of 9/11, and he did multiple tours in Afghanistan. He is, of course, now the man who stands accused of the recent shooting death of 16 Afghan civilians on March 11th, nine of them children. When you look at this incident, do you ever think back to, and we were talking earlier about the stress on your men and what they went through, and one who even went on a zombie walk, as you described it in the book, where he just walked aimlessly toward a group of attacking insurgents, right into the line of fire, and had to be pulled away. Could Robert Bales have been one of your guys?
Yeah, totally. I mean, in a counterinsurgency fight, which is what we're doing right now in Afghanistan, is incredibly difficult and stressful on soldiers because they're forced to go from kinetic. And what I mean by kinetic is they're forced to go from kill mode in a firefight to wrapping a blanket around a child in a village. I mean, that you're talking about oscillating between two extraordinarily different emotional states, from compassion and love for the citizens of Afghanistan to trying to find and kill an enemy who's trying to kill you. So the stress of counterinsurgency operations is already an incredible it's an incredible stressor on our soldiers, and specifically with this while none of what I just said excuses what happened in Afghanistan with Sergeant Bales, but it's I can see how something like that would could happen. I think it's the worst thing that could have happened in the wake of the Quran burnings. Robert Bales, this guy had multiple tours. He had three tours in Iraq, and he was on his fourth tour in Afghanistan. If you do the math, every other year this guy was deployed. And when you deploy like that, I talk about in Outlaw Platoon about how combat affects human beings. And the question that you ask yourself is, how can I maintain my humanity in an environment that is combat, that is inherently inhumane? And the longer you're there, the more your humanity slips away. So the longer that these guys deploy, the men and women of our armed forces become almost automatons, and there's a survival function that is happening with people when that happens. It allows them to see horrifying things and endure. It's they go numb, and so I don't think I can't tell you exactly why Staff Sergeant Bales did what he did. But, I think he needs to be held accountable for his actions, because otherwise it's unfair to the victims. But, he did deploy four times, and he was, he lost part of his foot in Iraq. He suffered from a traumatic brain injury. I think clearly he has a post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think all this needs to be taken into account. Our military is strapped and struggling right now.
Sean Parnell is our guest, and again, our number 412-246-2002. You suffer from PTSD, which is, again, post-traumatic stress disorder. What is that like for you?
I do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason that I'm so open about it is because there is a clear-cut stigma in the United States military with regards to soldiers seeking mental health care. They're afraid to seek mental health care because they don't want to be perceived as weak in the eyes of their comrades. They don't want to leave their comrades, so they don't want a diagnosis of PTSD, so they don't seek it out. So for me, in the military, we lead by example, and I was a ground combat leader, and so that's why I'm open talking about it. I have PTSD, and I think by me saying that, it lets soldiers know that it's okay for me to suffer. If here's a leader that leads by example, he's suffering, it's okay for me to suffer too. So that's why I'm so open talking about it. But it's a huge adjustment. I still struggle every day. I still have difficulty sleeping. Sometimes I have horrible nightmares. I can't help when I walk outside looking around to potential, ambush sites or immediately looking outside and analyzing the terrain with regards to like where would be a great place to attack me. It's just these things seem to be burned into my genetic code, And combat changes people. Men and women that have seen close combat are forever affected by, post-traumatic stress. But it has been a huge adjustment for me, and one that's been ongoing 6 years later.
Our guest is former Army Ranger Sean Parnell, who's just written a very compelling book called Outlaw Platoon. We have some callers on the line that want to talk with you, Sean, and we'll start with Nick in Pittsburgh. Nick, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hello, Nick.
Yes, I'm here. First off, Sean, let me thank you very much for your service and for your sacrifice, sir.
Thank you, Nick.
I'm a Navy retired Navy veteran from the first Gulf War, so you were a little kid back then.
I was. I was.
I can't even begin to fathom what you experienced and endured. So again, thank you. My specific question to you is, you pointed out that there is a rift between the general civilian populace and the military, because we don't have a draft, and I think you're spot on with your comments about why there won't be a draft. Can you think of any way that we as veterans or even folks in the military can try to bridge that rift? What can be done to get a better appreciation between the civilian populace and the military for what you guys have gone through? And I'm thinking more than just the magnetic stickers on cars.
Yeah, Nick, this is my mission. This is, part of why I wrote the book was to give words to the experience of my men in combat. So there is a rift between American society and her warriors. And I think what needs to happen, the first step that needs to happen with regards to bridging that gap is by American society reaching out to veterans and saying, look, I know that you're that you're hesitant to tell me about this story, but I need you to know that I can handle the good and the bad. I can handle the funny, irreverent times in combat, and I can handle the horrifying situations as well. And while, yes, you're right, I can never truly understand what combat was like, teach me what it was like so that I can help you bear the burden of war. You know, in American society today, our society, it needs to own the wars that we waged or that we responded to, or however, whatever, regardless of the politics, our society needs to own the wars, these wars. And our society, by owning them, will help veterans bear the burden of wars. And I think it starts with just asking veterans to tell their story so that they can help them bear the burden of war that has been locked up inside thousands of veterans over the past 100 years in our country. And I think that's the first step. And it's what a great question.
Nick, thank you for the question and the call. We appreciate it. Sean, after your first taste of battle in Afghanistan on May 7th, 2006, which resulted in victory, you write about being conflicted. And in the book, you ask yourself if Sean the human can coexist with Sean the combat leader.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to answer that question?
Yeah, that is a question that runs through the heart of everybody that's been in combat. It's like, how do you maintain? I mean, you're forced with making such terrible decisions in combat that you ask yourself, like, boy, Sean the human being, the American citizen, would never make these kinds of decisions. I mean, like, so the question of how can Sean the human coexist with Sean the combat leader or Sean the warrior is one that I haven't really reconciled with myself yet. I still struggle with that question, because in combat there are no rules. In combat you're asked to do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do, and sometimes that means sending a guy into certain death to accomplish a mission, or killing to accomplish a mission. And that's just not something that human beings are – I'm not sure that – I mean, we've been waging war for thousands and thousands of years, but it's never easy executing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Executing war or fighting in combat. It's never easy. I know that's a kind of an understatement, but I still haven't reconciled that question.
And you talk about how you sort of acquired this, you know, as you're exulting in the victory and watching the insurgents, who nevertheless, mm-hmm. while being the enemy, are human beings, and,
yep.
and you kind of you can see what's happening in your mind, the conflict mm-hmm. that you are going through. You express it very well, and you talk about, wait a minute, I'm watching these guys get blown to bits, and I'm celebrating it, and yet you're appalled at yourself for doing so.
Oh yeah, I mean, so for being an infantryman, victory in combat is the pinnacle of being an infantryman. You know, it's like infantrymen that spend their time in the army that never see combat wonder how they would have reacted. It's sort of like being an artist your entire career and never painting a painting, you know? So our mission in combat as an infantryman is to close with and destroy the enemy, right? I mean, that's our mission. It's pretty cut and dry. And so in that first engagement, when I'm watching men die, I'm cheering and I'm saying, "Well, wait a second here, wait."
And not just die, but just really, literally, be blown to
pieces,
right?
And I'm sitting there watching and cheering, and my guys are like cheering, and I'm thinking, like, what is happening to me? What is happening to me? And you know, so again, the mission of the infantry is to close with, find, and kill the enemy. So we were doing that; we were accomplishing our mission. So I think that's why I was happy. But you try to take a step back from that and look at it at an arm's length, and you think, well, what is happening to me? This isn't the Sean that was eating Christmas cookies with his family 6 months ago, you know? And this is the burden that is placed on young Americans every day.
Another thing that stands out in this book is the extraordinary courage that you exhibit. And sure enough, a month after this battle on May 7th, which was an extraordinary victory. At that point, one of the biggest that the U.S. Army enjoyed in Afghanistan since 2002. So then a month later, the outlaw platoon is almost wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a passage that I would like you to read here that sort of describes what happens and the moments leading up to that when you must summon up the courage to battle the insurgents against extraordinary odds because your men are outnumbered.
Yeah, so this is a passage from a chapter called The Zombie Apocalypse about June 10th, 2006, a fight that we were almost overrun. And it says, "Time to get online with the rest of the men. I steeled myself. The volume of fire sweeping the hilltop made May 7th look like a warm-up exercise. I moved to the Humvee's fender, ready to make a run for it. There's only one way to handle a moment like this one. Courage is a fleeting commodity and can be crushed effortlessly by a single fond memory of home, a backyard barbecue, a fragmented flashback to a moonlit dance with a beautiful girl. Those are psychological bullets in combat. One glimpse of what has been makes a soldier yearn for what can be again. That yearning can be as caustic as acid. It burns away the resolve you need to get the job done. One stray thought can paralyze just as effectively as a bullet in the spine. Give yourself to the moment, Sean. My legs began to move. Still dizzy from the mortar blast, I ran like a drunk across the open space, hearing the whip crack of bullets all around me."
This was June 10th,
yes.
2007. You had had been, as one of your members of your platoon said, you were blown up.
Yeah.
You had been knocked off your feet by a blast, and you described the blackout in such perfect detail. And it happens not just once, but twice. You get knocked out. You're concussed, and yet you're trying to get yourself back on your feet and out there to help your men, because you can't just stand back and watch and lead or supervise from a distance. You've got to be out there, and you've got to fire some shots yourself. How did you end up summoning up the courage?
You know, I had been, like you said, knocked unconscious twice. I had a spontaneous cerebral spinal fluid leak. So I had clear fluid leaking from my nose and from my ears.
And you're thinking too, by the way, that, well, it's not blood,
yeah,
so it must be,
yeah.
I don't know where this is coming from.
Yeah, it was just clear fluid. I was like, okay, it's not blood. Good. I'm not, you know, it's not blood.
There was a problem.
Yeah, clearly there was a problem. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was what inspired me to get up and get myself into the fight, because a platoon leader's job is to be in the center of the fight in the most dangerous place on the battlefield. An infantry platoon leader leads by example, and the motto of the infantry is follow me. And in order for people to follow you, you have to be out front. So when I was trying to get myself up after being knocked unconscious twice, what propelled me to move was the love for my men. And that's it. I don't have any other explanation. And it was because I wanted all of us to get out of there alive. It was because I cared about them and their families, and I loved them. And that's why I did it.
Sean Parnell, former Army Ranger, is our guest, and his book is called Outlaw Platoon. We'll have more on this topic and take more of your questions at 412-246-2002. When Essential Pittsburgh continues, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is 90.5 FM. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is former Army Ranger Sean Parnell, the author of a fascinating book called Outlaw Platoon. He is from Pittsburgh and has been a decorated member of the military, having received 2 Bronze Stars and the Purple Heart for his bravery and actions in combat in 2006 and 2007 in Afghanistan with the legendary 10th Mountain Division. He is a Duquesne University graduate, went through his ROTC training there, and where he earned his commission. And so he is from the Pittsburgh area, lives in the Pittsburgh area, in Cranberry to be exact. And clearly, Sean, there was and is a manpower shortage in Afghanistan that has resulted in multiple tours of duty for men like those you commanded. With the U.S. military heavily committed in Iraq at the time you were there, how much harder did that make your job?
Oh, during our train-up, when we were trying to figure out what Afghanistan was like, I mean, we knew that the entire political apparatus in the United States, as well as the military brass, were wholeheartedly focused in 2006 on the growing insurgency in Iraq. I mean, the situation in Iraq seemed to be spiraling out of control, and they were focused on that while Afghanistan The war in Afghanistan in 2006 was quote unquote won. It was nothing more than a stability and support operation. So when we were training up, we did everything that we could on our side. We were running 30 miles a week. I think my battalion shot over 1 million rounds just to get ready for like what combat might be like or what we thought it might be like. And we couldn't even glean bits of intelligence from Afghanistan on our enemy or our area of operations because there was nobody focused on what was happening in Afghanistan at the time. So when we got there, we were totally surprised about how quickly in 2005, 2006, and 2007, the situation in Afghanistan was spiraling out of control quickly. And we were not fighting. What we thought we would be seeing was like insurgents with pitchforks, maybe ill-equipped rifles, but that was not the case. We got there and we immediately saw that our enemy had been fighting for the better part of 30 years in the Russian war. They cut their teeth fighting the Russians in the Afghan Civil War in the 90s and now us. So the average age of the Haqqani Network fighters or Taliban or even these al-Qaeda jihadists from all around the world, they have 10 years combat experience on your average American private. We were shocked when we saw this. I mean, no amount of training can prepare you for facing a seasoned light infantry force like this. And get this, even the equipment that we were using in Afghanistan, we barely even had up armored Humvees. We were using the one up armored Humvee in Afghanistan that we had when we got there in 2006 was from Bosnia. So all of the high tech, super sexy armored equipment was going to Iraq. We eventually got that stuff, but it was about 6 months into the deployment. We were basically patrolling in Humvees that were essentially like pickup truck, the pickup truck version of the army of the Humvee, with soldiers sitting in the back bed of the truck. We didn't even have armored vehicles when we were there. We made do, and I think we did okay, but it made it a lot harder. There's no question about it. It made it a lot harder, especially the first 6 months of the deployment.
And in the battle that I described in the previous segment from June 10th, where you got knocked out a couple times, half your squad was injured severely. There were some very serious injuries that came out of that. And you guys came very close before backup arrived. You came very close to hand-to-hand engagement with the insurgents. And this brought to light one of your biggest fears, which was the fact that in addition to the grenade launchers and the AK-47s and the rockets that these guys had, there were also 8-inch swords or knives that they carried, and you were worried about one of these things that apparently the insurgents really were hoping to get a chance to do was to behead American soldiers.
Oh, that was as the deployment wore on, I was really scared of that. I was petrified of that, and I made sure that I wrote about those fears in the book as well. So on June 10th, they had over 100 fighters. We had 24 people on the ground, so we were outnumbered 3-1. In addition to PKM and RPK belt-fed machine guns that were used on the support by fire, airburst mortars that they were using to keep our heads down, AK-47s, they had these 8-inch knives all of them had these 8-inch knives sort of hanging off of their belts. And we knew that their goal, just by listening into their radio chatter, because they basically talk on walkie-talkies, so you grab a walkie-talkie, turn it to their channel, you can listen to them. We knew just by listening to what they were saying that their goal was to overrun a unit and cut our heads off. That was what their goal was. And here on June 10th, 2006, that was happening.
Came very close. Yeah.
And there I was on the line about 20 meters, 30 meters away from an enemy that was about to overrun us. And I'm like looking up and down the line wanting to scream fixed bayonets. And I realized that we don't carry bayonets anymore. So for a young combat leader that's 24 years old, what do you do with that situation?
Sean Parnell is our guest. His book, again, is The Outlaw Platoon. 412-246-2002 is the number if you want to get in on the conversation. And I want to go to a question from Muhammad in Pittsburgh. Muhammad, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yeah, are you there? Hello?
Yes, hello, Muhammad. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for being involved. Yeah, I was interested, Sean, with his background, and given the, presidents used to be also of the military background in the history, like the forefathers. I was wondering, would he have conducted the war differently in Iraq and Afghanistan? Given the technology now and sort of the fighting we have, it's a different sort of an animal, I would think, the war is. could we have saved more lives for our servicemen? And could we have done it more surgical strikes and things like that rather than this prolonged war of 10 years? I mean, where a lot of men and women have lost their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how would, I mean, and what realistically are we getting out of this over the next 10 years? I mean, would we have made any changes there? Or, I mean, or is it going to be the same? I mean, could we have done it differently? Anything like with more education or with more education on these countries rather than, you know, just the firepower?
Yeah, that's a big question, and I'll try to answer it as simple as I can. I think for me, I think that if I were to do anything, you know, differently, you know, I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback here, I would have focused, if it were me, if I was the president of the United States, I would have focused on Afghanistan first. I just would have. I think that we went into Iraq prematurely. Before we let the tactical situation and intelligence unfold. And I would have focused on the war in Afghanistan first to make sure that that situation was under control. I think that, you know, we saw during the Clinton era in the mid-90s where there was an abundance of, you know, what he described, what the president, the office of the president of the United States in the mid-90s described as surgical strikes. I'm not sure that they were that effective. I mean, but I think our biggest mistake, looking back, is that we simultaneously were conducting two wars. And I think what we should have done is focus solely and exclusively on Afghanistan, like I said before. And if we were going to move into Iraq, I think we should have let the tactical situation unfold a little bit, let our intelligence develop a little bit, and then moved in. But I think the fact that we started conducting these two wars at the same time, that's one of the main reasons why we've been there for so long, because the situation in Iraq started unraveling, so we focused there, and then now here we got, now that Iraq is quote unquote under control, now the situation in Afghanistan is unraveling, so we're dividing our efforts where we should have just focused on one at a time, if you know, in the very beginning. I mean, that's what I think the simplistic answer to a very complicated question is, and that's just Sean's two cents anyway, for what it's worth.
The nature of the war required a lieutenant like you to be a warrior diplomat, and describe the fine line you had to walk and how difficult it was, particularly when you come up against one of the more interesting characters in the book, Major Ghul, which is his actual name. He's the commander of the Afghan border police, and this is one of the people that you had to sit down with and, in the interest of diplomacy, avoid offending from the time you first met him, even though he's lying to your face pretty much the whole time he's talking to you.
It's such a great question. I mean, there I was again. I was 24 years old, zero diplomatic experience whatsoever, not only no leadership experience whatsoever, and I'm sitting down next to a guy that's in his mid-40s, and all Afghans are the epitome. I mean, they are the best diplomats in the world. I mean, these people have been – I mean, most Afghans do not know their country without being occupied at the same time, and so they're perpetual fence sitters. They play both sides expertly. These people are the most experienced diplomats the world has ever known. They are survivors. And my first experience with Major Ghul was the first real leader engagement that I had with anybody in Afghanistan that had a position of power. And I learned that leader engagement was a microcosm of the larger foreign policy or geopolitical situation that's going on in Afghanistan right now. I mean, you've got a guy that we're paying and we're equipping both militarily and with their uniforms and supplying, and then he's taking those weapons, he's selling them on the black market, and then our enemy is buying those weapons that we are selling to the border police in Afghanistan. It's just this nightmarish situation, and how do you even negotiate with somebody like that, who's so clearly, I mean, he might not be on the enemy side, but he's clearly not on ours. And I say in the book, it's like an Afghan version of a get-rich-quick scheme, you know?
Right.
And so I had no idea how to deal with the situation other than just nod my head and smile, you know?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like the character on MASH who's shipping Korea home one piece at a time, you know, yeah. to try to line his pockets. This guy is lying to you saying, you know, all of our equipment's been, well, didn't we just supply you?
A month before.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's all destroyed, and so that you'll resupply him and then he can turn around and sell it to the insurgents. When you say that this is a microcosm, is it in fact, I mean, people have talked about corruption in the Karzai administration.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is this a microcosm of that?
Oh, totally. I think that... Wow. Yeah. I think that Afghans, I mean, it's part of their culture to lie and try to sort of scheme the best deal for their tribe. But yeah, I think that corruption runs rampant in the Afghan government. And I think that corruption jeopardizes our mission there. And it's not something that they're doing necessarily to exploit us. It's just something that they've been doing for the past 1,000 years. When you're talking about a country in Afghanistan that most people in Afghanistan don't even know how old they are. Most people in Afghanistan know just their tribe. Oftentimes, they don't even recognize that they live in a country called Afghanistan. So they don't even realize – I mean, the larger geopolitical situation in Afghanistan, they just don't really care about. They're just trying to find – like what's the best way that they can survive given the situation and circumstances around them, and how can they skim a little money off the top?
There are some lighter moments in this book, such as when you accidentally exposed yourself in front of some elders.
Yeah.
How did describe, if you would, if you don't mind,
no,
how that happened?
No, this is my first leader engagement with a group of village elders, the power brokers in our district. And as I was sitting down, army soldiers in Afghanistan back in 2006 and now are. It's a cumbersome – your uniform is relatively cumbersome. You've got your body armor. You've got your chest rack with your magazines, your rifle. And I sat down and, you know, infantrymen oftentimes in combat don't wear underwear because it can chafe you in the field. And without showers, that chafage can get infected. So oftentimes we don't wear underwear going commando. And so I sat down and as I sat down, my trousers split. In front of all the local elders. So there I was, trying to be a warrior diplomat, somebody that's the ultimate power broker in the area of operations, trying to negotiate on behalf of the United States of America while simultaneously accidentally exposing myself in the first leader engagement, you know? And I mean, the Afghans were laughing, my squad leaders were laughing. To this day, I haven't lived it down, you know? It's just probably the worst thing that could have happened given the circumstances.
One of the lighter moments in the book that really highlights so much a part of the story of the Outlaw Platoon, a book that will make you laugh, it will make you cry. And our guest is Sean Parnell, who is the author of that book. We'll try to get to as much feedback as we can in the few minutes we have remaining with you, Sean. We have an email from Alicia in Cranberry Township. She says, please ask Sean if he is familiar with The Unforgiving Minute by Craig Mullaney, also of the 10th Mountain Division, and was his, meaning your experience in Afghanistan, similar?
Yeah, I am very familiar with that book. Craig Mullaney was part of a battalion, 1st Battalion, 87th Infantry Regiment. I was a part of the 2nd Battalion, 87th Infantry Regiment. So it was a sister battalion. And what's so interesting about The Unforgiving Minute is that Craig details his story at a place called Shkin, which is basically 45 minutes south of our area of operations in Bermel. Only he was there in 2004. I think Craig's book differs from mine in the sense that it talks about his experience in a very sort of linear way as in school, at West Point, Rhodes Scholar, Ranger School, and then a short talk about his time in Afghanistan. But whereas my book is I think, strictly about the combat itself and really about the collective group of men. But yeah, Craig's book is he's an American hero and his book is pretty incredible. And I'm very familiar with it. I mean, it's interesting that we're essentially part of the same division. It's a small army for sure.
You write in the book, in your book, Outlaw Platoon, that you wondered how we could return to our former selves after what this fight had done to us. Have you been able to answer that question?
No. And I think, I lost elements of myself that will forever be in the Hindu Kush Mountains in Afghanistan. And for me, I reconcile those aspects, and I think every veteran does this differently, but I reconcile those aspects of myself when I look into the eyes of my kids, who I see that innocence is still there. I see that spark in their eye that's still there that I know that I don't have. But I complete the whole, or I reconcile that loss when I look in the eyes of them, and that's what gives me hope. I'm lucky to have an amazing wife that is supportive of me, and two amazing kids that help me. But you know, I think that those aspects of myself are gone forever. I don't think that I'll ever be able to reclaim them.
Before we run out of time, we've got about a minute left. There was a character that you, a very touching part of the book, is one of the unsung heroes, one of the interpreters, or one of the terps, as they are called, mm-hmm. a guy named Abdul. Talk about Abdul and why he meant so much to you.
Well, he was inspired by the same thing that inspired me. I mean, his father joined to help the United States after September 11th, and his father was murdered. Abdul took up arms against the same people that murdered his father in the wake of 9/11, and I joined the army in the wake of 9/11. So two different men, two different countries, two different cultures, same mission. And I don't think enough people talk about the plight of the interpreter. They live in a constant state of limbo. Once they join the United States, the cause of the United States, they're never trusted by their tribe again, while simultaneously they can never be trusted by American soldiers. And I was very close to him. He was an incredible guy. And I felt like I needed to capture that in the book and write about him as well.
It's just one of the many great aspects of the book, Outlaw Platoon, written by Murraysville native and former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger Sean Parnell, who's been our guest. He served in the legendary 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain after receiving 2 Bronze Stars and the Purple Heart. It has been a pleasure getting a chance to meet you. I really enjoyed your book and would recommend it to anybody.
Thank you. And if you have more questions for me, you can get on my Facebook page at facebook.com/outlawplatoon, and I try to get on there every day to answer questions from people. So you can get at me there if you have more thoughts.
Sounds good. Sean Parnell, author of Outlaw Platoon, thank you for being here. And that'll do it for today's edition of Essential Pittsburgh. The program is produced by Marcus Charleston. The assistant producer is Heather McLean. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We'll see you tomorrow with another edition of Essential Pittsburgh.